Guys, welcome once again to your Adonis Lifestyle Podcast. I am Brad Howard, and on the phone, John Barbin is with me, and we're going to talk about something really, really interesting today. And, you know, it's going to be funny. We've kind of been talking tongue-in-cheek about health benefits, and we know that there are some people that maybe have some cognitive dissonance about kind of getting involved with AI or even the Venus Index, based on, you know, the fact that we're saying that this is the most attractive body. And, you know, people a lot of times don't want to seem like that they're being, I guess, what's the word I'm looking for, John?
Vain.
Vain, perhaps, yeah. Even though it's not really a vain thing, we're just kind of calling it the way it is. So what we're going to do today is we're going to pull back for a second because we're really getting some evidence that not only is this the most attractive body, but if you're interested in health, and let's just say that all you're interested in is health, what we're finding is that this may possibly be the healthiest body you can have as well. So, John, let's go ahead and start with that. I mean, let's start with some of the evidence that just from some of our customers and things like that.
Yeah, well, I did my blood work not too long ago, and everything came back fine. So that's – and I was – you know, I'm at a 1.6 ratio. I fall within the normal for BMI, I fall within normal. So, you know, I know a lot of people, guys that work out, tend to think that you end up in the overweight or obese category when you're, you know, heavily muscled. But I don't think I'm lacking in the muscle department, and I don't even land in the overweight range. So I don't understand who these people are that do. I'm sure there's some genetic freaks who actually have a lot of baseline muscle, like endomorphs. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the BMI is relatively accurate, at least. Because the other way of thinking about it is that if it's not, then what am I, underweight? So we've been through this BMI thing. It seems like people who don't like it are people who get categorized in a spot they don't like what the BMI says. But, mm-hmm. You know, for people who are in the normal range, it seems fine to us. So whatever, whatever that means. And then an interesting piece of information. Rich, one of our guys, he posted in the blog or in the forum, and he sent this to me personally, and then I asked him if he would post it in the forum, and he was like, yep, sure. And he achieved a 1.6 AI. He actually put his picture in the forum, which looks great. But he got his blood work done at I don't know where he was. He said he was at a fair, and they actually would do your blood work screening for free. And
like a health fair, maybe?
Yeah, health. Yeah, it was a health fair. Yeah, sorry. And you know, his cholesterol came back great. His triglycerides were great. His good cholesterol was great. His bad cholesterol was, everything was like in great position. And he just said his blood pressure was like, you know, the nurse said he had the, you know, blood pressure of a teenager. And he said this was a huge improvement from 6 months ago, and he never really considered getting his body in an aesthetically pleasing shape would also get him into a healthy shape. And that was my kind of overriding point about the AI index as well, is that it's a healthy body is also a good looking body, or a good looking body is a healthy body. There's no such thing as, there's no other way around that. I don't think people can even conceive of a workout program or a healthy body that looks horribly unhealthy. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like saying, you know, where are you? And I'm like, oh, I'm east of the North Pole. Like, you can't be east of the North Pole. Like, it's impossible, mm-hmm. right? It's a logical trick. Like, there's no way to be east of something that you can't be east of it. But it's the same thing. It's like, oh, I've got a really bad looking healthy body. Like, that doesn't make any sense, you know?
Sure.
So, I mean, now some people might argue you can be thin and unhealthy, but I'm not saying a thin body looks good. I'm saying when your body actually looks aesthetically pleasing, that also sort of by default means it's healthy. And so we all know BMI is, you know, it's got its criticisms, it's got its critics. And people have to remember that BMI is meant for general assessments over across a whole population. Any single person may not necessarily fall exactly where the BMI in, you know, it may not predict them as well as somebody else, but for the most part, it's a useful predictor for the population. But that goes with any population sort of population metric. That's not new news. But then the height to waist ratio, so how big your waist is versus your height, is becoming an even better telling sign of lifestyle disorders. Basically, heart disease, diabetes, overweight, kind of the lifestyle disorders that we're kind of becoming familiar with in modern industrialized societies. And so I'm saying they're getting good with the height to waist, but they're missing out on the shoulder. Add in the shoulder, and I think you have the shoulder measurement, so the AI ratio itself. And to me, that's the best measurement of what I would call not just health, but vigorous health, like, and fitness. Because you can be thin. You can have a really good height to waist ratio. You can have a small waist for your height and no muscle mass, no strength endurance, you know, no quote fitness to speak of. You can just be thin. So I think adding in the shoulder ratio starts to speak towards, yeah, I have a low body fat percentage, which is the indicator on the waist, but I also have physical fitness, which is an indicator of building up your muscle mass. So to me, that's kind of the gold standard of what a healthy body would look like. And not only healthy, but I guess fit, whatever you want to call fit. I mean, to me, people seem to think fitness has something to do with movement and ability, like something to actually move around, and an ability to accomplish tasks, something to do with being able to, you know, exert energy. Whereas health people seem to think it has something to do with a lot of measurements about, you know, your blood measurements, your heart rate, your blood pressure, those sort of things. So it seems to be fitness seems to be more oriented to people think about how you move and your ability to move and your ability to do stuff versus health is more of a static state. So what I'm saying is I think our measurement captures both.
Right. Well, yeah, we're talking about not only vigorous, but we're talking, you know, vigorous ability, but we're talking about vitality and, you know, to a certain degree, you know, propagation of the species, perhaps.
Oh, yeah, it speaks to the concept of genetic fitness. Like, if you want to get really geeky technical, it's like literally the being higher on the scale of mate choices. Like, all things being equal, if you and I have the same job, we have about the same personality, you know, we say the right thing at the right time. All of those things, we're right on line on all of that. Mm-hmm. But I have a much better looking body than you do. You know, who's going to get the girl? Like, all things being equal, she's just going to be more fit, just flat out carnal physical attraction. She's going to be drawn towards me. And so, call it vanity, you know, people work out for looks. I don't care if they say it's for health. You can't say that you're training for health in spite of the look of your body. Like, there's no such thing to me, at least that I can think of. I don't think there's a workout program or a way to actually improve any measures of health that you're interested in without that also affecting the look of your body.
Sure.
So I don't think there's a workout program that makes you look worse but makes you healthier.
Right. You know, the one thing that I want to kind of point out, you know, if you're listening to this on the blog right now, there's actually a link on the site to, you know, Rich's, you know, actual post in the forum. So you can actually see it. I mean, it's pretty impartial. This kind of, we basically put this up here because obviously, you know, this is his result and he came to us with it. I mean, we didn't ask for it. So we definitely wanted to show you that because you can kind of get an idea of what we're talking about. But in reality, like I say, I mean, what we're doing right now is we're giving you permission to say that, because let's say with money, I know a lot of people that have kind of a mental block in their head about being rich. You know, they're like, I don't want to be rich. They just kind of have this attitude that rich people are like mean bastards or whatever, but they would like to have more money. And so they kind of reframe that as, well, if I have more money, I can help more people. So it's not about the money. It's not about being rich. It's about helping more people. And that's the reframe they use in order to generate money. And that's fine. So what we're doing right now is we're giving you a reframe that basically saying, if you kind of have this internal issue about this is vain and if I do this and this means I am vain, what we're saying is that you can totally rechannel this into health. I mean, if that makes you feel better about actually going in this direction, which we firmly think you should, then you can take this down the health path and know that if you go through this process, you are going to have, by every measurable marker that you can go, when you get your blood test done, when you're at a 1-6 AI, when you go get this done, every measurable marker you have will be in the high, average to high.
It'll be good. Like,
yeah, it's going to be good by every,
or if not improved from where it was.
Sure.
That's not with any special attention to diet either. Like with anything beyond calories in and out.
Right.
Now, if you arrive there and there's still something you want to improve on, at that point and only at that point is it worth examining whether or not you need to put something in or take something out. Like somebody else in the forum was talking about, a complicated explanation of types of food, like certain foods in and certain foods out, and he was all worried about cholesterol. And I'm like, oh, well, you know, what's your cholesterol? Have you even had your cholesterol tested? Like, why are you worried about something you don't even know what it is? And until you go get your cholesterol tested, how do we even know if it's needs to be? It's trying to like fix something that you don't even know if it's broken. So sure. get it tested, find out, and then if your numbers come back, well, first of all, if your numbers come back okay, you're stressed about nothing. So now you're actually compromising your health in the form of being too stressed about something that's not even wrong. Like there's nothing mm-hmm. wrong with you, but now you're becoming stressed. And we know that stress, neuroendocrine system, stress can actually start causing actual measurable health problems. Mm-hmm. So if you get yourself all worked up about it and there's nothing to be worked up about, now you're actually going to compromise your health by being worked up. So the mm-hmm. first thing you should do, get a baseline measurement. Everyone should go get all of this stuff tested. Just go to your doctor, be like, I want it all tested. Just test everything in my blood. Fasting, glucose, you know, insulin, all the typical, blood lipids, triglycerides, all that, cholesterol, all that sort of stuff. And then once you have your baseline, you have an idea of where, if you need to move, make a move, do anything or not. And then I think the very first movement is just lower calories. If you're eating too many calories, most of that stuff will be solved simply by eating less. And then, mm-hmm. and then at that point, you know, and then adding in the exercise. If you aren't exercising right now, add in exercise. And then now again, we're talking about health right now. General mm-hmm. health. But if you're going to go through all that trouble of exercising, why not also structure the program so your body starts accelerate how much better it can look with the structured program? Any amount of exercise is going to help. But mm-hmm. I mean, if you're going to kill 3-4 hours a week working out, why not also make them maximize the aesthetic, you know, angles and shapes of your body anyways? And then after, you know, a few months of pursuing that path, get your blood tested again. If everything looks okay, well, there's nothing wrong with you. Like you just sure. continue along. If there's something you don't like, or there's something that you'd rather want to try to improve on, at that point you can start looking at, oh, do I add in fish oils, or do I, you know, maybe try to look, eat more fiber, you know, whatever it is, remove a bit of sugar. But everyone gets all over this, like, you know, it's got to be this much fiber and this much, you know, get rid of this much sugar, zero trans fats. It's, you got to have your fish oils. You got to eat all these. You know, these ratios help with your, you know, controlling your insulin, all of this stuff. And like, have these people ever once stopped to measure their blood to see if any of that actually matters?
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. You kind of touched on a lot of that stuff. And we've talked about this in the past as far as, and we're going to go with the, you know, the talk about local optimums kind of again. I know we talked about this in a blog post and kind of in the last podcast, but you know, what a lot of people do is they don't start with the entire system of improving the entire system. They kind of pick something. They cherry pick something they're going to work on. So in the case of food, like you were saying, let's say yes, you're eating too much in saturated fats, but you're also eating 4,000 calories a day. So if you drop down to 2,000 calories a day, the volume of saturated fats that you're eating is naturally going to be taken care of, and chances are, even if you're eating the same exact foods, just by decreasing the volume, your saturated fat problem will be taken care of. So just going in that, just looking
at the very least, you would have cut it in half.
Right.
If you go from 4,000 to 2,000 calories, eat all the same food, you've got half of the saturated fat you were eating just the day ago.
Sure. Right. But in reality, like, going and doing that one thing, dropping the calories to where you probably need to be, more than likely is going to handle that particular problem and handle a lot of other problems as well just by doing that. So, right. So instead of going and saying, oh, I'm going to eat less saturated fat, but you what tends to happen is you translate that particular food to another type of food, so the calories are still there. So you still got the other problems you're dealing with, but maybe you're not your saturated fats aren't as high, but you're still overweight, so you're probably still on blood pressure medicine.
Yeah, this is rearranging the deck chairs while the Titanic sinks.
Sure. So here's where we're getting at with this is that, you know, handle what you need to handle, the big ballpark thing first.
Mm-hmm.
So get the calories handled first. Ride that out for a while. So you have to know where your baseline is, especially when we're talking about health. You have to know what you're trying to change and why. So obviously you go get all your stuff tested out. You find out what your baseline is, and then you get an idea of what you're eating. You drop that down to where you probably should be, to where you're losing a little bit. You go get tests a month later. You see what happens. Chances are, just by doing that one thing, everything's going to be measurably better. This is the same concept when we're talking about with AI. We're already seeing, as far as health is concerned, and when we describe health, we're talking about the measurements that people go to the doctor and get measured, and or say they're normal or it's high or it's low or whatever. That's how we're classifying health in this particular podcast right here. Okay, so for our measure of health, for AI, if that's the thing, shoot for that 1.6 first. So if you're overweight, lower calories, you know, work out the way you need to work out, what we're saying, shoot for that 1.6. Then once you get to 1.6 and get everything tested, if there's something you need to work on locally, like if maybe your blood pressure's still a little high, or maybe, you know, your cholesterol's still a little high, then at that point is when you would work on that. After you have all of that other stuff handled, you kind of – that's when we say it's about optimizing the entire system and not optimizing this local kind of phenomenon. And I know that sounds kind of complicated, but it's really not. It's probably the easiest thing you could ever possibly do. If you thought about it like your body is a big black box, you know, what goes in, and then there's this black box, and then what comes out is this result. I mean, obviously what you want is that result at the end to change. So that's kind of, like I say.
Yeah,
I
think people get caught up reading the fitness and nutrition marketing, and it's easy to start reading about one thing and start worrying about like doing the local optimum, just thinking of the one thing over and over again, but never seeing it as it relates to everything else. And also the other thing is not putting it together that total calories affect all of those things. Like that's actually, I think, the biggest disconnect in the entire health and fitness nutrition diet industry. No one considers, like, people can, right off the bat, I'm sure if I say cholesterol, people probably think something to do with fiber, or like that you can deal with it, or fiber has something to do with it. And then blood pressure, and they're like, stress, maybe, or salt. I think people keep, you know, saturated fat and cardiovascular disease. I think people have these like little links. They're like, oh yeah. Saturated fat has something to do with cardiovascular disease. You know, stress has something to do with blood pressure and sugar has something to do with insulin. And I think people can piece those little optimums together. They're like, oh yeah, that goes with that. That one goes with that. So that's why I need to control each one of these separately. What people never manage to put together is that most of those things are only a problem when you have you're completely in excess of all of it. So if you're eating at or below resting metabolic rate and living, you know, a somewhat active lifestyle, none of that stuff matters. Like none of that stuff really is going to have any effect at all. Like who cares how much protein or fat or carbs or how much saturated fat is built into the mix of foods you happen to eat. If you're only even eating just to RMR, there's almost zero chance you're actually going to have a problem, like a saturated fat problem or a blood pressure problem or any of these problems, like a glucose or sugar or insulin problem. You can't really have those problems if you're not in a massive excess in the first place.
Right.
Or doing zero exercise and living a very stressful life and like it's kind of like the fixes are really, really simple and they kind of fix everything. And I know that takes like the mystery out of all of it, but you know, if it's like, you're just like picking on one little thing, but you know, if you're still eating, if you're not exercising at all and you're eating in a pretty big caloric excess, like 1,000, maybe 2,000 calories above, there is nothing you can do to fix any of those local optimums. Like it doesn't matter how you rejig your saturated fat content if you don't cut down the total calories. It doesn't matter how you rejig your sugar content if you're still eating too much. So it's,
right.
I suppose it takes the fun away from reading about all of this because people think, I think, you know, when you and I talked about this, I think people identify themselves with the way they eat and the way they try to take care of themselves. It's like, you and I even mentioned it. I think people attach themselves to an identity about it, even without the benefit. Like, I think people will attach themselves to a vegetarian diet regardless and never bother to go get themselves measured to see if it's doing them any good. You know, they might say they feel better. And if that, you know, and if that's all you wanted to do is feel better and it worked, great, that's fine. But without really knowing if it's done anything for you, I think people attach themselves to diet lifestyles for an identity. You know, you've got vegans, vegetarians, paleo people, you know, whatever. I don't know what the diet style is, but people choose to live these lifestyles. I think it's more of a romanticism about the lifestyle than it is any proof that it does anything. And very few people that I ever talked to produce any measurable data that it did anything for them. Like they don't, you know, I don't see people talking about their, you know, their something changed in their blood parameters or, you know, it didn't really did much. It seems to be an identity that they're interested in, regardless if it does anything for them. They just want to identify with something and that sounds good to them.
Yeah. Let me give you kind of an analogy. I was thinking about this yesterday. I was riding down the road in my car or whatever, going to the gym, and I had the music blaring. And, you know, I look in the mirror and my mirror is shaking, you know, from the bass in the car, right? And it was a rock song. I forget which one it was, but you know, that song had a lot of treble in it. It was just loud all the way across the board. And I got thinking about it. I was like, you know, I can hardly see anything out of this mirror because it's shaking so much. I could probably turn the bass down that I could see. And I got thinking, well, you know, the only other problem with that is that, you know, I could also turn the treble down so that maybe I don't blow my hearing out while I'm riding down the road. And I was like, or I could just turn the volume down. And it kind of handles all that.
Yeah.
It's kind of the same thing. It's kind of the same analogy. It's like, why turn the bass down when, you know, now I've got something else that is kind of hurting me. Yeah,
too much treble. You just deal with it all by reducing the volume.
Yeah, volume. Yeah. So same thing with volume of food. It's like,
yeah, even the word's the same. Volume of food, like less of it.
Sure. Well, yeah, that's why I thought about it. I was just kind of riding on there. It's weird when you things kind of pop into your head, but. You know, I was, like I say, I was just riding down the road and thinking about it that way. And I didn't change anything because I like loud music, but you know, it was just funny. You know what I'm saying? I was just kind of, you know, but here's the deal. I only listen to loud music every once in a while. So I am essentially fasting from loud music. So maybe that'll help.
Yeah, I think you're stretching there.
Yeah, I know. I'm not listening to loud music all the time. I'm not consistently.
You're intermittently fasting on loud music.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, so, yeah, I don't know. It's. The identity, I'm sure some people took offense to the whole identity thing, but you know, I don't really care because that's to me is what's going on. It's, the identity with food or the identity with a lifestyle around food. It doesn't even make sense to me. I don't know why anyone would identify themselves that way. I've read a bunch of books about that. Reformed, Health Food Junkies was an interesting book for anyone who wants to try it out. It's an MD who got himself really into those circles. Like he started identifying himself as a macrobiotic person and then all the different stuff, like a locavore and all that stuff. But when you explore any of those ideologies and really spend some time researching them, you realize they're more a fleeting romanticism about an idea, but there's not a whole lot of meat on that bone. The rabbit holes on each one of those goes really, really deep. Like the idea of trying to eat organic, like do you even know what organic means and the amount of industry influence there is in the idea of what organic even is, or the idea of locavorism is just ridiculous. It just doesn't work at all. And it's a concept that only affluent people.
What is that? I don't even know what it is.
It's the idea of eating food that's like with really close to where you live. So oh, it's like okay. It's produced, farmed, and you know, and raised where like within. You'd say the 100-mile diet. Like eat any food that's only is accessible from 100 miles away, mm-hmm. Which is absurd. What am I supposed to do in Canada during the winter? Right? Like you have to. Like it's the type of philosophy or mindset that only affluent people can even think about. Like, so while half the world's starving, a bunch of affluent people in North America can like pick and choose where they get strawberries from because they think it has some sort of impact on the environment. So it's, mm-hmm. it's kind of, once you take those ideas past their like the first sentence and start reading and researching about them, you realize it's what you thought it was isn't what you think it is at all. Mm-hmm. Like the reason why we get like fruits and vegetables from all over the world is because it's actually economically more feasible to get it from far away than close by. And then sure. If you tried to do the local movement, you'd end up cutting off any local producer from exporting their product any further than 100 miles away. So you're killing their business too, all for the sake of some ideology that you think it's somehow better for the earth. So it's, you know, and that, you know, like you'd have massive shortages all over the place and all kinds of farmers going out of business from that. So it's, and you wouldn't have the range of foods that you have now. You'd only have what grows in your area, which, mm-hmm. you know, for a lot of people, they would be, their diets would shrink up pretty tight to just a few foods. So it's like not everyone lives in a fertile area. So it's kind of I know that kind of view and other kind of, I just call them romantic views of eating. It's just we can't mm-hmm. really do things that way. It's just not, our food supply structure isn't set up that way. And if you really did try to do it that way, you'd end up losing out on a lot of foods. And then for anybody who lives in a northern climate, all throughout the winter, you'd have to eat stuff that's all preserved because nothing grows in the winter.
Right.
So, yeah, you know. There's a reason why the global food supply is the only reason why in the middle of December I can still go get a banana. Like right. Bananas don't even grow in Canada anyway, so it's like where would I even get one? So,
yeah, it's interesting. I saw something about that the other day, and I was doing a little research. I mean, not a lot. I mean, basically, I'm kind of like you, in that sorry about that, but I just kind of look at something really quickly, and if I see there's you know, a bunch of conflicting advice, like right off the bat. And I know that it's probably not even worth digging into even more because the rabbit hole just gets so deep and, you know, opinions get splattered and you've got so many different directions that it could go. Like in this regard, you know, people were making the argument that, you know, local is, you know, it's, as far as an environmental footprint, it leaves less of an environmental footprint. But then, you know, if you really break it down to economies of scale, and you start talking about the actual footprint per, you know, so versus having a big airplane ship.
You know, oh, it gets worse.
2,000 bananas versus a truck shipping, you know, 50 bananas. You know, your actual greenhouse gas emission per banana is going to be greater with the truck than it would be for the plane. And you start getting into all that. Then you start getting into local economies and breaking down local economies. And, you know, certain people are good at what they do and they're very efficient at what they do. And mm-hmm. so you lose efficiencies and all of this other stuff that nobody really kind of, which also has a certain footprint on the environment. It's not just the travel that comes into play. It's also the actual being able to be more efficient and effective.
Efficient travel and efficient supply.
Sure. Yeah. I mean,
that's why I call it just a romanticism of it and not an actual well thought out idea. Because when you actually drill into the data, at least on the locavore issue, you realize that in many cases, the local thing has a way worse impact on the environment. Mm-hmm. It's because now you've got more smaller trucks driving around in a smaller area when one truck could have gone to a distribution center. So it's, you know, And they don't have the ability to produce, like you said, work on more efficient movement. Like if the idea is to lower, like for instance, let's say the carbon footprint or the emissions, it would make more sense for engineers just to figure out how to make more efficient trucks in the existing supply than it is to force people to buy from local farmers. Because now more people are in their cars just going to their farms.
Sure. Oh yeah.
Whereas the industrial supply as it is already designed to be as efficient as possible. Like they're not... There's not an extra truck on the road that doesn't need to be on the road because it just increases cost.
You know, it's kind of funny. We talked about this, and I got a couple other things I want to talk about before we finish this up, one being that admiration thing. But, you know, if you really think about it, if you think of money like, I mean, it's obviously currency, but if you think of it like water, it usually follows the path of least resistance. And so in this regard, the reason that you have places that are supplying from different areas is because
it's the most cost effective.
Right, exactly.
It actually already is. And I mean, I guess to close just, off this whole locavore argument and the food thing, which is, I don't know how we ended up over here, but,
health.
Health. Yeah, well, I mean, if, you know, no, it makes sense because there's two things. You can look at your health and you can also look at the choices you make that include, if you want to be really broad and sort of big picture minded, you can look at the choices you make that affect your health plus the health of the environment if you know, wanted to go that direction with things. And, you know, and some people think about that, but what I'm saying is your health is pretty simple to look at. Like you can go get all your blood parameters tested. You can assess yourself just in how you feel. You can kind of do a self-assessment on your, I guess, state of emotional health. Like, are you comfortable with your relationships and how you're like, you know, you're pretty happy with where you're at and, you know, all measurable things come back looking good. So you're like, this is the best I can do. You know, I may get hit by a car today, but you know, I haven't stimulated any worse off. My health is as good as I can make it, so to speak. And then the other thing you can look at is like, now am I actually having a better or worse impact on the environment while I'm also trying to be healthy? So that's like the even broader view of it. And so, I mean, but what I'm saying is the second half, that my impact on the world sort of thing, is much harder to quantify, and it requires a lot more research to figure out exactly what your, like, as far as food, simply just as far as food choices. Like, it's not that obvious at all. It takes, like, there's quite a bit of digging you need to do to realize that, oh, yeah, like, the choice you make between the regular apple or the organic, you're not really doing that much, or like the local apple may actually be worse for the environment than the other one. Like there may have more carbon and more oil and more expense and more government subsidies and more farmers in some area have gone, you know, in some other area of the world have gone out of business because of tariffs on the second apple, not the first apple. Like that takes a lot of reading and a lot of research and a lot of fact checking to know if your decision, to know what decision you made at the store, what it actually did.
Right. So basically, here's the gist of it and what I'm getting for you and just kind of what I've been thinking. In this, and especially when we start talking about optimizing the system versus local optimism, thinking in that regard, when in doubt, and actually that's not even say when in doubt, but your health and your progress and everything about you and what you need to do to be able to do what you need to do takes priority over all of the other stuff. So if you, let's say for instance, you don't have a lot of money, but you would like to buy organic, but you can't because it costs a dollar more per celery thing or whatever, because typically it's more expensive. Well, I mean, the thing is that your results take precedence over everything else because
over the environment. So like, is the piece of celery better for it? Is the organic one really better for your personal health than the other one? Or are you doing it because you think it's better for the environment?
Yeah, your impact on the world has more to do with what you actively contribute from yourself than it is from a lot of the little decisions like this. So, I mean, basically, if you know, you're not, I mean, if you're not in the shape that you want to be in or whatever, you can't encourage other people around you to be in better shape. I mean, if that's something that you're looking to do, you can't, I mean, your opinion kind of doesn't matter anymore. It has no weight.
Yeah, so being healthy, in shape, confident, capable, getting stuff done, taking care of yourself is the best contribution you can make.
Sure.
Oh, then, yeah. Other than like, you know, trying to show off to people that you chose the organic apple versus the other one, but you still don't have your life in order and your relationships are falling apart and you're not really pulling your weight at work.
Yeah, I'm gonna say this. If you're, this is probably the most non-PC comment I'm ever going to make. But
are we being really critical today?
I don't think so. I think we're just kind of – people have asked us to kind of explore some of these things, and we're just basically helping people direct of where their attention and focus really needs to be.
All right. Well, let's hear your non-PC comment.
I mean, think about it this way. If And I'm not saying this because this is necessarily what I believe, but this is reality. If you are overweight and you're trying to get people to eat organic, nobody is going to listen to you.
Even if you're right.
Even if you're right. Yeah, exactly. You have no proof.
It's weird. It doesn't even matter if you have scientific proof about other people. They want to know that you can apply it. This kind of goes back to what we talked about last week. People seem to want to know what the experience of doing it is more than the data on what the data says it is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so weight loss, people don't care if like a weight loss researcher exactly knows weight loss 100%. Like they've studied it. They totally know how it works. They want to know what it felt like.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, did you lose weight? And the researcher's like, well, no, I've always been thin. They're like, well, I want to talk to the people who lost the weight. He's like, well, I can tell you what happened. They're like, no, I want to hear from them. Even though the researcher probably knows better, like actually knows what happened in their bodies, it's in this instance, like health and weight loss, it's really personal. It's all about feeling. I don't know why, but it's like people don't like the idea that it's like a measurable statistic. Like they don't want the researcher saying, oh, everyone's blood pressure was here, everyone's cholesterol was here, everyone's LDL. They're like, no, I want to know what it was like. Mm-hmm. I don't care what the charts say. So I think that's why people get like, it seems like kind of Huxley, Brave New Worldish. People are like in hatcheries and stuff. Like I think people just, health is so personal to people, they don't like the idea that it's categorized in spreadsheets and charts.
Yeah, it's funny. Like we're saying, I mean, it's if you have a specific, especially in revolving food types or health or however you want it to be, the best thing you can do for whatever cause you're backing is getting into the best shape possible.
Yeah, from a health standpoint, and then people will start listening to
your
message of like, oh, and by the way, I actually kind of have a clue about the actual mechanism behind this.
Right. I mean, you actually have proof that it can work. So, I mean, I see this a lot where you get a lot of people, like, for instance, not to pick, but, I was walking through the bookstore the other day, and I saw a Dr. Phil book, right, on weight loss.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, really?
Yeah, he's not in any shape anyone wants to be in.
Sure. And so it's kind of like, all right, well, where there's no proof. He's kind of evangelizing a certain way of doing things. However, it might be right. It might be the best thing ever. But the problem is that because he's not there, he's doing what he's evangelizing an injustice.
Yeah, because there's an inherent hypocrisy to it.
Sure.
Even if he can get everybody else in the world to do it, people need the evangelist to do it too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, and like I say, this isn't trying to be overly critical. I mean, this is just kind of stating what we know to be true about how people operate. You have to remember that we have this big free range experiment going with Adonis. I mean, we've been doing this for 2 years, and we kind of see what people are, how they're reacting to certain things, what they want to see, what they want to know, what kind of proof they want.
Mm-hmm.
At what point do they believe? At what point do they need some more convincing, so to say? And it does, it's really never about what you say versus what you can show or demonstrate, which is really important.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, it's not like I said, like coming, if we go back to, some of the things that guys are asking me about as far as, what to say to women and stuff like that. It's kind of going back to that. If we go back to that, it's really not necessarily what you say. It's kind of who you are and what you demonstrate or as far as who you are, what other people tell that person about who you are. That's what really matters. Those words are one thing. Those words coming from one person that has a lot of respect in an environment, they could be the exact same words, same tone and everything, go a lot farther when that person has demonstrated they have, a certain amount of value in an environment versus someone who doesn't have that, that same thing. So it's not the words, it's not the actual content or context of what somebody's talking. It's that trust value, it's that believability.
Yeah, it's like the Super Bowl champion coach calling a play, or some kid who plays PlayStation and he's like, well, I think this is the right play. I mean, you're going to trust the coach even if they both call the same play.
Sure. Yeah. So I guess what we're getting to with this before we transition really quickly is that if you have to lead, you have to get yourself where you want to be. And before anyone's going to believe, you have to, the proof has to be there before you start evangelizing, because people are going to be like, yeah, right. It obviously didn't work for you. So, because, and if it was that easy, you'd be there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of interesting. That kind of transitions into one thing I think we've been wrong about. I'm not going to say wrong, but we kind of undershot the bow on something. And, you know, we've kind of discussed it a little bit in the past. We've kind of touched on it. But, you know, we've talked about this being kind of the most attractive body, and maybe that's something that, you know, people are having a lot of some vanity issues with, and maybe some cognitive dissonance. But I think where we really miss the boat is I don't think it's the most attractive necessarily. I don't think that's like what it really is. I think it's the most admired. And that's why that's a totally different mind space. You start talking about admiration versus attraction. Admiration is good. Attraction equals, for some people, manipulation. I'm trying to do things to, you know, to kind of get. But being admired, I mean, people admire art.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is another reason why, like I say, I mean, this is kind of a concept I've been floating around. But I also think this is why people have to change the way they act once they start getting a better body, because now people start to admire them, and, you know, that same old BS doesn't fly, because as soon as you say something, do something that's kind of incongruent with that admiration that they have for you, it just totally destroys it.
Yeah, they're actually expecting only certain things to come from you.
Sure. I mean, at this point, they're looking at you, admiring what you've done and all this other stuff. And
you're on the hook for not bursting their bubble.
Yeah.
Like you can't be a goof after that. You actually have to be like what they want. You get into that kind of shape, they're like, you look like a leading man. You better say and move and do the things a leading man does.
Oh yeah, you have to lead. And this is evidenced in some of the research I think you pulled up, you know, back in the beginning. We should probably bring this back up at some point, where talking about people, you know, people that are attractive go farther in life and things like that, which is kind of true. However, what tends to happen, this was really interesting. It's kind of a double-edged sword. If you get somewhere because you're attractive, you have a certain amount of, I guess there's a certain expectation for you. So you might get the job over someone else. However, if you don't do well.
Oh, there's a fall from grace. Yeah.
The backlash is a lot more than it is from someone who doesn't have that. So that's kind of something you have to be prepared for, is that, you know, you're doing this now, the total expectations from you are increasing. Now, of course, I mean, if you're being, now this is kind of a total kind of going on a high gravity thing, but it's kind of a total thing. I mean, if you look like this and the next thing you know, you're a liar, it's worse if you look good and you're a liar than it is if you look bad and you're a liar. It's I know it sounds really different, but it's like that vacuum space between what people perceive and what actually is totally. I mean, it just once it sucks.
It's like the
together,
deception's even worse.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
Because we're at a kind of at a genetic carnal level where you are still drawn to that person from a physical level, and then you get bitten by the lie. Whereas someone who you weren't really all that physically attracted to, it's no big deal that, oh yeah, and they're also deceitful. It's like, well, there's nothing that's attracting me to them now, neither physically nor from a personality level.
But it's also insulting to the person who is at the other end, because, you know, everyone thinks that they are a good judge of character. And so all of a sudden, you know, you present yourself in this manner and then it blows up in their face.
Oh yeah, they fall for the halo effect because you look good. Mm-hmm. And then they feel like an idiot with egg on their face if they end up getting double crossed or exposed for making a bad call on character, bad judgment.
Sure. So I mean, you know, if as long as you're not a con man, you need to pay attention to this.
Yeah.
If you're a con man, you're like, you know what? We just told you the secret to getting what you want. Just do what you got to do, and then, you know, disappear, and nobody will know.
Yeah.
It won't matter then. But, you know, if you're dealing with people consistently throughout your life, these are the things that are why. Because now, now people, and we've heard comments from Jason, Ron, you know, some of the other winners that we've interviewed of, on how people are treating them differently now. And it's, like I say, it's not for Jason, you know, he was, I think he was saying he was teaching and he goes back and the students are all asking him kind of like, wow, that's not an attractiveness. They're not attracted to him per se. Now some may be, but you know, even the guys in there, they're not like, you know, attractive.
Yeah, they admire him now.
Right. It's this admiration that is kind of at the forefront now. So you have to really understand that. And I think it's a lot easier. I did a podcast with Adam Galad the other day, and we kind of talked about this a little bit. But I like admiration versus attraction a lot better because it seems to be more kind of intrinsic on what you need to do. Mm. You know, if I said to you, John, what are you doing to be admired today? You could think of a couple of things that would probably be help you out with that whole being admired thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's kind of, you know, walking an old lady across the street. I mean, you know, that would, if somebody sees that, they would probably say, oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, but, that has nothing to do with attraction, yeah.
Right, it has nothing to do with that. But that attraction kind of, you know, it kind of drags behind the admiration.
Yeah, because eventually you become a person that people want to be around.
Sure. And, you know, if we take that to, you know, AI, when we're talking about the whole, you know, AI, the health is kind of dragged behind the AI ratio.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So it's kind of that whole same thing. And like I say, I kind of like this because this whole kind of different way of looking at it, because it just starts to make more sense overall. I mean, if you think about how can I be an attractive guy, it's not really, for most people, it's not really that like cut and dry.
It's not all that obvious, yeah.
Yeah, it's really not. I mean, people start to ask, I mean, what's attractive? What's this? What's that? And then you have, again, all these other local optimums that people are trying to do. Well, I got to come up with the money pickup line, or I got to dress a certain way, or I have to do this, or I have to do this. And so those decisions on the direction you need to go, they're not very, it's not clear. And so people don't do anything. There's no clear direction.
Yeah, it's hard to get started when you don't know where you're going.
Sure. But when you start thinking in admiration, the direction's kind of clear. I mean, there's pretty much only – I mean, there are certain ways to act and certain things to do that if you're thinking in that headspace, that only makes sense.
Yeah, that could even be one operating rule that rules them all. It's mm-hmm. In any action I'm going to take, is this an action that I would admire in somebody or not?
Yeah,
and view yourself that way. So if that's an admirable action, it's probably worth taking. If it's not,
am I the admiral of my life? That's kind of funny because I just put that together to admiral and admired is from the same root.
Mm. Yeah. So I mean, and if that's your kind of operating sort of marching orders, just that's not an admiral thing to do or not. And then you're like, oh well, if it's not, then probably not a good idea to do it.
Yeah. I think we're kind of starting to get into heroism and being heroes for other people and being and inspiring other people. That's really what this is.
You know what? There isn't much of it. There really isn't much of it. Very few people do much of anything for anybody else.
Uh-huh.
And it feels pretty good to do it if you actually do it. And other people kind of come up and say, hey, man, that really helped. Like, that could be the best feeling ever. It's just very few people ever. And it's not like people don't want to. I think they just don't even know where to start or how.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the simplest thing is you could be a role model. Like that's kind of where the whole AI thing sort of to be admired, to have a bunch of, it's happened to Jason. A bunch of guys in his gym want to train with him now. Mm-hmm. So he's sort of taken them under his wing. But that wouldn't have happened before his transformation, right? So it's sort mm-hmm. of, and that, you know what? I guess we should wrap this up, but to finish it all off, and I don't know if this is a good or bad thing, but when you start to get in that good of a shape and you've shown people that you've worked for it, now you're on the hook to – you're kind of inadvertently in a position of authority.
Mm-hmm.
So you're kind of – whether or not you like it, people are going to be looking up to you and they're going to mm-hmm. be asking. So you either gracefully accept that role and help them out or sort of – I don't know, just tell them you're too busy and kind of go about your own business. But regardless, people will look at you and people will want to know what you're up to and they're going to start asking. So it opens up the opportunity for you to have big effect on other people's lives if you want to. Mm-hmm. But, which doesn't exist until you've shown them you've got something of value. So it's, you're kind of on the hook. It's sort of what we were saying all along here. You're, it's cool because now people are literally going to be hanging on what you say, but you say the wrong thing and then it looks, doesn't look good. So it's sort of, you know, just be genuine, but the opportunity exists once you get there.
It's really interesting that you said that, because what I found, you know, just kind of from, even from that perspective, is the more and more I kind of get into this, and the more and more I'm writing, you know, because we're, like I say, I'm, you know, got the, writing the reports and the books and stuff like that around, surrounding high gravity and kind of my experiences and perspectives and, you know, what I've seen and, you know, all this type of stuff, and kind of coming up with some of these basic paradigms of how this whole thing works. It's almost like I'm writing this thing for me, because I know what's going to happen. I've already started analyzing a lot of different things of how, okay, is what I'm doing running, you know, congruent with this, or is it running against it? And it's kind of like, all right, we put this out there. It's kind of like with AI. You know, you put this out there, you get there, you're kind of on the hook, but it's a good thing. It's kind of like this, it's like this external, not, I don't want to say compliance, but, you know, it's like this external, this other thing that, instead of it being all on you and self-control and all this type of stuff, now you have this external reason to do something and to, mm-hmm. to keep yourself in check or whatever and live the life that you really want to live. And, you know, when we talk about, you know, some of these, you know, in emotional control or whatever, I talk about being in kind of a hot state or an aroused state. It's a lot easier when you can kind of self-check and say, you know, if I do this, what are those people that I just told this, or that we've kind of come together on this? What are they going to think if they find out? And that kind of place. So that's interesting. It's a rare, it's a good thing, because everyone thinks about kind of, I don't want to say jumping off the wagon, but you know, I mean, we all have different thoughts and things like that about what we're going to do on a daily basis in different pools. And, you know, maybe some hot chick comes across or whatever and, you know, wants to talk to you, but you're married and you're like, oh, you know, if I was 10 years younger or whatever. But, you know, when you have kind of that external thing where, you know, people are looking up at you.
Kind of, it keeps you in check.
Sure.
Keeps you on course.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And that's a good thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, totally. And that, I guess that comes back to the whole, why Dr. Phil can't give weight loss advice. Because even if he lost weight at some previous point in his life, it's clear that he's not in that shape now. So why would we listen to him?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I guess let's wrap this up. Where do we end up here? I guess we started with health.
Yeah, we started giving people a reason to pay attention to us, because we're not trying to get everybody vain. That there are some other methods to the madness that you can actually attach to, you know, actually using the Adonis Index as your only measurement tool. But number one, again, because it's clear, same thing with Venus Index. I mean, these things are clear, but they're also embedded in all of this stuff is, you know, we're transitioning from attraction to admiration, which is a good thing, which that's, again, cognitive dissonance where people are kind of having that vanity thing. And we can switch that over to admiration. So we won't even talk about attraction anymore. We'll talk about admired, because art's admired. And so we talk about admired, but then also with that admired state that other people are looking at, you've got health that by all measurements is embedded in it as well. So you've got one number that kind of rules everything, which is pretty awesome. You've got the admired state, you've got the health, you've got your sanity and all this other stuff. Again, we're not trying to sell anything. It just kind of is what it is. I don't know. I think that's kind of it. I think that's kind of where we are.
And I think the one other piece that really feeds to the admiration thing is, this is not the type of body you just have. You have to work at it. So people mm-hmm. admire not only the finished product, but they admire what you probably have to do to get it.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It's like it speaks kind of at both levels there.
Yeah. Do not underestimate what is implied when you step out and you look like this. There's a lot of things that are implied. It's kind of like, I'll say this and then we can kind of close it out. But, you know, a lot of people say women are attracted to confident men. It's not the confidence per se that they're attracted to. It's the underlying things that are implied when you're confident. Confidence generally is a good indicator of success and other things. So it's not that it's this one specific. It's not that people are admiring the fact that you have this body. They're also admiring all. It's kind of intrinsic in what they see. They see the book, the outside, but they know what it. They know inherently what it took to get there, and they also admire that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that's
it's the look and the life, I guess.
Yeah, it's a look, the life, the work ethic, the it's a success, you know. I mean, that's
I think we're just sort of beating it up now.
Oh, well, that's what we do.
Yeah, well, I know.
So, all right, man. Anything else? Anything coming on the horizon that anybody needs to know about?
I think we're gonna talk a bit about muscle building because we haven't talked about it in a while. So we'll dig into some. We'll dig in the next. Either if not in the next show, in the next couple of shows, we'll start getting around to picking apart some muscle building research and calories for muscle building.
Okay. Really, really cool, man.
Yeah, man.
All right, John. Well, I appreciate you being here again. For John Barbin, I'm Brad Howard, and this is your Adonis Lifestyle Podcast.